I thought we could maybe look at a subject we've never really studied in depth before, since we are now beginning the reading of the Torah from the beginning, and that's a time, of course, to examine fundamentals, underlying themes in the creation, which obviously all relate to not only the universe, but to each one's inner universe, and also to each person's relationships, because obviously all dimensions of the world are products of the original elements or energies that go into making it up. So let's take a look at one of those themes, which is maybe in one way perhaps the most basic of all themes, and that is the theme of male and female. You know, we just finished reading the Bereishis, the Genesis, the creation itself. And we just now coming to the description of the flood and the Teva, the Ark, Noach, Noah. Let's see if we can try and put some of these things together. But a lot of this is esoteric and even Kabbalistic and abstract, but very Torah subject and very, very deep and very much the root of all applications. So let's make the effort and see if we can track it through. The first step in creation, really, is to set up male and female. Obviously, when we understand these things deeply, then we'll understand a theme in the human mind and heart, because each person has a male and female component. And of course, if you understand that clearly, then you can work on understanding the depth of relationships, male-female relationships. So there's plenty of practical output to the subject. But first of all, the beginning, the first step in creation, is really to set up a male-female pair. And the reason is that before the creation begins, we understand that Hashem is one. One means the root of all things that will manifest, the root of male and female too. But we say Hashem is one, even though the oneness we're referring to really means a oneness that has all the parts. But as soon as Hashem, as soon as God creates the world, if you like, he sets up a female element in the world. You know, it doesn't take much experience to know that we always refer, almost always refer to Hashem, to God, as male. But why is that? Why do we always speak about God in the male? Is it because we are, you know, anti-feminist, medieval, misogynistic, no, putters down of women? No, it's because maleness means, what male means, is a multipotential source of creation. And what female means is the vessel that holds the creation. You know, the names of Hashem are always expressed in the male. The world is always female. The Hebrew words for the earth and for the world are always female. Even if the word itself doesn't suggest that, the word Adama, obviously a feminine, the earth. But Eretz, which means the world, the earth, that also takes the feminine. And vessels are feminine. Even the stones, the basic building blocks of reality are really the stones of the earth. You know, there's no more basic building block of the physical world than that, in gross terms. The Gemara says that the world began from a stone, Evan Shasia, Evan Shtia, the rock of formation, if you like. You hear it a little bit better in the word sur in Hebrew. The word Evan is a stone. The word sur, they translate in English as a rock. But actually the word sur is much more than a rock, because the root in Hebrew means a fount or something that the Hebrew word sur, which means a rock, is the same as the root sayar, which means an artist or someone who forms something. But the word stone, Evan, is a feminine word. The Beis HaMikdash, the temple, stands on a rock, right? I mean, not at the present time, of course, but that is the rock from which the world, the creation, spread. And the word Evan is feminine. Some commentaries point out that the word Evan, which is the feminine root of the world, actually is a conflation of two Hebrew words, Av and Ben. Right? Evan is a flowing together of the two words Av and Ben, father and son. The transition from father to son but is feminine because it takes place in the woman. Right? That's where the transmission from one generation to the next takes place. So the world always is a feminine thing. Male and female are always regarded as the first step of creation is called Mashpia and Mekabel. Mashpia and Mekabel. The dimension that gives or influences, that's called male. And the dimension that receives and holds and reproduces, that's called female. The very beginning of the Torah, the first step in creation, is that Hashem created heaven and earth. So in English, it's almost the words are almost useless. Heaven means nothing, earth means nothing. But in Hebrew, Shamayim and Aretz, a very distant echo of those words is what we call the heavens, meaning, I suppose, space and the cosmic space, and Eretz, meaning the earth itself. The real root of those words in Hebrew is much deeper than that. When the Torah says that Hashem created heaven and earth, it means many things before it means the sky and the earth. Shamayim in Hebrew, in English, is the word Shamayim in Hebrew, which they translate in the King James Bible as heaven. The word Shamayim in Hebrew really means ultimate destination. Right? Anyone here speak Hebrew? Anybody? Who speaks Hebrew? The word Shamayim, the root of the word is Sham. Sham always means an expression of essence. Sham in Hebrew means destination. When you say there, the final endpoint of any journey is called Sham. Shamayim means Kol HaShamim Kulam. All the endpoints. Shamayim is the Hebrew word, the plural of Sham. Sham means there, endpoint, destination. Shamim means where all destinations meet. That's called Shamayim. So it means the place to which all movement goes. When you get there, there's no further movement. That's the destination. And the Hebrew word Eretz means running. Eretz, al shem haritza. Eretz means running towards. So that the world is really a movement towards a destination. And the next world, Shamayim, what they call the heavens, let's say, is really the point of destination. That's what it means. The world is a journey, it's a movement, it's a process, and it moves towards a destination, which is the culmination, which is nothing other than what the journey reveals or builds. And that's how the creation begins, heaven and earth. Right? Again, in English, these things pale into insignificance. But the real concept is that the first thing Hashem created was a dimension of hashpa, that means influence, where energy flows from, and then a vessel to hold that energy and manifest it, right, and reveal it. And that's the pattern of male and female. Male is always, the male dimension is always a limitless dimension. Hashem is always male. It means it's a dimension of energy which has no limits. The female is always completely limited. The female dimension is always completely limited, because in a real world, you can't have something unless you limit it. In the world of potential, you can have all things at once. In the world of the actual, if you do that, you have nothing. When you have a male energy, for example, let's say you have to build something, you have a project to complete. It's an architect, he has to build a building. The male phase is all the inspirational potential, all the things it could be. But you can't build a building like that. When you build a building, it can only be one building. Is this clear? Yes? No? Blank. That's what it is. The potential, all things are possible. But when you build a thing, you can only build one. You have to sacrifice all the others. The ecstasy of the male dimension is the fact that it's multi-potential. All things are there. The sadness of the male dimension is that it's only potential. You have nothing in the world. The man doesn't get married. Nothing comes to expression, to fruition. The sadness of the female dimension is that she must limit. To give birth in the world, she has to give birth to only one thing at a time. The potential is lost. And the ecstasy, if you like, or the brocha, or the elevation of the female is that it lives, it's alive. You see it in so many ways. The word for male in Hebrew is zachar. Zachar in Hebrew means male, but it also means a memory. Zachar, right? Zachar is a memory. What's the connection? Because the father, the male, the father is no more than the memory of the previous generations. What is his part? What part does he play in the formation of a child? The father gives only a half a genetic code. All he does is give a compressed essence of what he received, right? Distilled into a speck of genetic material. That's all he does. And she builds it into a reality. The word zera in Hebrew, which means a seed, is the same numerical equivalent as Hebrew word zikaron, which means a memory. What is a seed? What is a seed? A seed is a compressed memory. All it is information. If you take a little seed of a tree and you cut it open, a little acorn, you don't see a little tree inside. You see nothing. But you have the most compressed essence of memory of what. And when you plant that, you get a tree that can make its own seeds, which has the potential for more. It's an infinity contained in that seed. An amazing secret. But it's only a seed, not a tree. And the female dimension is when it grows. When it finally, the Hebrew word nekeva, which means feminine, means to make limited. To specify, to limit a thing. The female power, the power of the woman. You know, the Kabbalists explain, maleness is the right-hand side, and female is the left. The left is called gvura. Gvura means power, but it's the power of limitation. It's the power to hold the thing and make it limited. And of course, the sadness of that, or the curse, if you like, of the left-hand side, is that it's only that one thing. The blessing is that it lives. The word nekeva in Hebrew means to make specific. Like it says, asher nikvu b'shemot, who are fixed by name. Or when Lavan said to Yaakov, nakva alai schacha v'eten, fix your wages and I'll pay you. Give me a number. You want to be paid? You've worked for me? Give me a figure. See, maleness is where the potential. Imagine someone says to you, quote a figure and I'll give you that much money. Say any number you like. Imagine someone walked up to you, someone with unlimited wealth, and said to you, say any number you like, I give you that much money. The beauty of that, the ecstasy of that is there's no limit. But the sadness of it is, unless you say a number, you get nothing. So what do you have to do? You have to say a number. The moment you say a number, two things happen. One is you get that much money, unbelievable, but not one penny more. To have a thing in the world that's real, you have to sacrifice all the more that it could have been. And that's why the word feminine in Hebrew, nekeva, means to fix, and it means a curse. The Hebrew word nekeva means fixed, made specific, and also means a curse. Like it says, nekev shem Hashem, right? You can't even say that in English. One of the worst things a person could do would be to curse. I mean, we can't even say that. So the conventional way of saying it, that sin, right, in English, I suppose it's called blasphemy, I suppose, but the way it's put in Torah sources is Birkas Hashem. That means blessing God. We don't mean blessing. We mean the opposite. We mean cursing. We couldn't say that. Right? That's called, that same word, why? Why is the beauty and blessing of the female also have a manifestation of curse? Because when you limit a thing, the Torah concept of blessing is that a thing is more than what it appears to be. Right? What is the dimension here of blessing and curse? What does that mean? The concept of a blessing, bracha, right? Baruch, blessing, bracha. What does that mean? What does a blessing mean? In English, these things are very vague. A blessing means, I don't know, something sort of holy. That's not what bracha means in Hebrew. Bracha in Hebrew means a thing that becomes more than what it is. A multiplication, right? A bracha is where the thing has an inner content that is always more than what it appears to be. Many ways to show that. One beautiful way to show it is that the word bracha is made up of twos. The three letters of the word bracha are 220 and 200. All the dualities, right, where one has become two. In fact, the Gemara says that the sages say that very beautiful ancient medrash in a work, Oseus to Rabbi Akiva, an ancient midrashic source. So there, the medrash says that when Hashem wanted to create the world, He began to decide which letter was a suitable letter to begin the world with. How should he begin the Torah? With which letter? The Torah, the creation. Obviously, the Torah is the map of creation. So all the letters came before Hashem. All the letters of the alphabet. The Hebrew letters, they came before Hashem. Each one claiming, start the world with me. It's a very deep meaning here. But at least on the surface, Each letter wanted to be used to create the world, and they came in reverse order. And Hashem rejected each letter. And when he got down to the base, Bet, the second letter, the letter that means two, Hashem said, Bereshit, in the beginning. The world starts with you. And then the Aleph complained, of course. Had no chance. And Hashem said, "This, I have another purpose for you." And of course, when Hashem created the spiritual world, Anochi, Anochi, Hashem Elokecha, I am, that starts with Aleph. But Hashem started the world with the letter Bet. And the Medrash says, because that's the letter of blessing. Beracha starts with a bet. It's a letter of blessing. And therefore, he wanted the world to be a place for blessing, for ribui, for multiplication, that things should get more. And therefore, he started the world with a letter bet. So the famous Ibn Ezra, many centuries ago, Ibn Ezra says, I don't understand this medrash. What does it mean that Hashem started the world with a bet because the word bracha starts with a bet? That doesn't make sense. How would you challenge that? If you wanted to challenge that notion that the world starts with a bet because the bet is the first letter of the word bracha, how would you challenge that?
You said bracha is more than the creation of God's limits.
You can have another nice word for
excuse me?
No, the word wouldn't have existed before anything else.
Because Baruch was existed after the word.
It's all the wrong way around. The word only exists because the world exists, because he started.
That's the challenge. There are lots of bad words that start with a bet. That's what he says. He says that you mean to tell me that the world is created with a bet because that is the letter of bracha, because that word begins with a bet. But that's arbitrary. You pick out one word and you say the word bracha begins with a bet. There are a lot of bad words that, you know, words that I'm not blessing at all that begin with a bet. So the Maharal has a famous attack on this. The Maharal says that, he speaks very strongly, it's very, very hard to repeat this, but Maharal says the Ibn Ezra didn't understand what the sages were saying, and imagine speaking that way. Maharal lived hundreds of years after the Ibn Ezra. But he said that this is not the concept. The concept is not because the word bracha begins with a bet, but because a bet is the letter of blessing. And the reason is because it means two. It's the first multiplication. The first development you have after one. The first step in making many from one is two. Once you've said two, you've said it all. Once you've taken oneness, indivisible oneness, and shown that it can manifest more than one, that is all. Is this clear? Yes, no? That's included in what two means. Two doesn't only mean two. Two means that one has multiplied. And therefore the word bracha, the base, that letter, is the letter of blessing, not because the word bracha happens to begin, but because be'etzem, that means essentially, that is the letter of blessing. And therefore the world started. The Chazal said the world was created only for multiplication. Only for multiplication. That means the human being's purpose is to multiply. Gemara says, the purpose, get married and multiply. Loi tohu bra'a, Hashem did not create the world to be uninhabited, unformed, but leshevet yitzara, he made it to be inhabited. It's not a Jewish purpose, by the way, it's a human purpose. People talk about overpopulation and zero population growth, and it's better to have one child and two puppies. Not right. The purpose of creation is to multiply. That's the purpose.
If the purpose is to multiply, why the Mishnah, if I'm not mistaken, you never got married?
It's a big problem. You choose the one exception. He tried to get married. He tried. But he was so in love with Torah that he couldn't relate to a woman. Why do you ask me about him? Why don't you ask me about Moshe Rabbeinu, who separated from his wife? And I also tried. But it's not for you. You get married. The world is created for multiplication. That means for the relationship, right, between the giver and the receiver. That should multiply. That's the purpose. That was the original purpose of mankind. It's to fill the world. But the deep meaning isn't simply that there's a benefit. What is the concept? Lot of hurt. It says it's not good for a man to be alone. You get married and have children. It's not good to be alone. And a relationship must be fruitful in many ways. You have a fruitful relationship even without children. The relationship itself is its own fruit. By the way, a person can also be fruitful in himself. A person who is spiritually productive is also considered to be building a relationship and producing. What's the proof of that? What's the proof that a person can produce deeds in the world that are considered his children? Because it says in this week's Parsha that Noach, right? Noach ish tzaddik, yes? It says, Eile told us Noach, these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man. So the Chazal, sensitively, hear it like this. These are the generations of Noah. Who are they? Noah. He was his own offspring, meaning his deeds in the world. That's also valid. But essentially, there needs to be a productive relationship. What does it mean that it's not good to be alone unless you have children? That's good. Why is that good? The children also not good. Because they also, until they have children, where does it end? That's not the concept. The concept is that the multiplication itself is a bracha. Bracha means the increase. The mystical meaning of bracha is that a thing can increase. For example, it says, "Ena bracha shrei ela bedavra samim in ayin." Blessing is only in things that are hidden from the eye. Because when a thing is revealed to the eye, it cannot increase. Gemara says, for example, let's say you go to measure something. A farmer walks down to his grain store, but he hasn't seen inside how much grain there is. Before it's opened, he can pray, he can daven that it's more. He can pray that it should miraculously be more. Why? Because as long as no one's seen it, it hasn't been measured, it could be more. But once he's seen how much is there, you cannot ask for such a thing. Once the eye has seen it, the simple understanding is because it would be a miracle and that God doesn't reveal miracles. But the deep meaning is that once it's been seen, it's been measured, and once a thing is measured, it's frozen. It's nakuv, that means it's cursed in the sense of being limited. That's why we are always trying not to expose blessing, we try to keep it hidden.
Wave collapse, sorry.
Because when a thing is hidden, then it can have a blessing. When it's revealed, this is the secret of Ayin Hara. The Ayin Hara means when you look at a thing, how does the eye damage? How does looking at a thing damage something? What is this, some superstition? No, very far from it. When the eye sees a thing, it can no longer be more than what you've seen. When the eye sees a thing, it limits the thing. When it's hidden, it can be more. This is also why we don't count people. The Torah, a very stringent prohibition of counting people, doing a census, very serious problem there. Because once the thing is numbered and counted and measured, then it's... The word for feminine means to make the thing specific. The beauty of that is it's real in the world. The damage, the danger is that it's only this. How's a child formed? The male component is infinite. In the world of biology, especially in the world of mammals, the male gives seed by the billion. The woman gives one seed at a time. I'll never forget the amazing experience of having to dissect a human embryo. An unborn human child. So you see, when you examine the tissue that becomes the ovaries, the organs that form seed in the male and the female, you know, they both begin in the same place. They begin in the kidneys. When the Torah talks about seed producing organs, it talks about kidneys. Very deep idea. Why? But biologically, the kidney, part of the kidney, the embryo, breaks off and starts moving down in the body. And that tissue that begins to become factories that produce seed. And in the male and the female, the very same tissue becomes completely different. In the male, they become organs that produce seed by the billion, not million, by the billion. And the female, the very same organ becomes an ovary that produces the number of seeds that you can count. If you take a cross-section of the human ovary, you can count every... And if a woman ovulates every month of her fertile life, she uses every single one. And when male meets female, billions meet one. Maleness is a infinite potential. And femaleness is, take this one and all the rest are. All the potential that could have been is no longer. Tremendous curse, tremendous limitation, and a tremendous blessing, a child is born. But it's only this child. The greatness of the birth of a child is that a human being is born. The sadness of the birth of a child is that it's only this one. All the billions that it could have been are energy that died. The Kabbalists say that the world is a sad place for that reason. The world is a brilliant, ecstatic place because it's a world. It's our opportunity. It's our life. But it's only this world. It's no bigger and it's no smaller. It's only this particular world with a moon that color and a sky, you know, exactly this world. Could have been more. The Midrash says that when Hashem created the world, the heavens, the world began expanding at an infinite rate until he yelled at them, Achegar Bahem, I don't translate that, he shouted at the world, Va'amalem Dai, he said stop. Dai means din, the left hand side. And the world stopped and froze at this into the dimensions that it has now. It's a world, a beautiful, amazing, incredible world. Exactly. Why did it stop at this size? Why not a little smaller? Why not a little bigger? Why are there as many stars as there are out there? Why not more? There's room for more. There could have been less. There could have been more. There's plenty of room for more. That's the exact correct number to show the oneness of Hashem. That's a deep mystical secret. But it's only this world. And that's the male-female connection. Is the male is a hopeless overabundance of energy. Vastly more than could ever be expressed. And the female is the limitation, which the world needs. You can only have a real thing in the world when it's just what it is. This is also the reason why in Torah law, a man can marry many women. A man, we don't do that, and it's been outlawed in the Ashkenazi world for many centuries, and even in the Sephardi world, it's not, and never was a Jewish tradition. It was unusual to do that, but theoretically, a man could marry many women because maleness is a multi-potential source. That's what being male is. But a woman cannot marry many men. First of all, what woman in her right mind would want more than one husband? I mean, it's a bizarre idea. But a man could handle that idea. Certainly could. Because he is that multi-potential source. And that's the idea. The world has this infinite potential but limited reality. And that is the duality. That's the male-female. Shamayim is the dimension of infinite potential, what's called mashpia, and the world is the mekabel, the receiver, the vessel that holds it. And you know, in marriage, the Torah says that, how do you affect a marriage? How does a man marry a woman? So it says certain ways to marry a woman. One is to give her an object of value. Let's say a ring is what we traditionally use. By the way, why do we use a ring? Why do we use a ring? You could give her a brick, you know, something useful, you know. That would be too dangerous, maybe. But anyway, something. The symbol of a ring is the female shape. A ring, a perfect circle, is a unique shape. It's the only conceivable shape that has no uniqueness. That's the female shape. A circle is the only shape conceivable by the human mind that has no yichud. There's no, every part is the same as every other part. There's no other shape like that. There's no other shape that doesn't have some uniqueness. Even a straight line has an end, two ends. A ring has nothing unique. Each part is exactly the same as all the others, and each part predicts the totality. You take the smallest part of a circle, already you see that if you continue it, you'll have a circle. In fact, amazingly, you see, the secret of maleness is a point of origin. There was nothing before, and there's something now, a seed at least. Femaleness is the secret of continuity, not origin. Maleness is origin. Shamayim, that means the heavens, where the influence comes out from. And femaleness is picking it up and moving it ahead. The Midrash says that if you read the whole Torah from the beginning, from Genesis, Bereshis, you'll find that for the long section from the beginning, yes, there's no samach. You know, the samach, the Hebrew letter samach, is a perfect circle. Right? In Genesis, there's no samach. In Bereshis, the moment of beginning is all origin. There's no letter of continuity. The first time a samach appears is in the creation of woman. Vayizgol basar tachtena. Hashem took out the rib, took out man's rib. Right? And he closed the flesh. So when the Torah says he closed the flesh, the yiskor basar, he closed the flesh. And in the formation of woman, for the first time you have a samach appearing. Amazing idea. There's one exception on the way, but the rivers that come out of Eden, there's a Samach there, the Midrash talks about that. But essentially, the whole of Genesis. There's another section in the Torah that has no Samach either. A whole parsha in the Torah, no Samach. Try writing a few pages in English with no S. The other part of the Torah that has no Samach is the part of the mitzvah of Bechor, the firstborn, obviously. The firstborn, point of origin. Not continuity, but origin, is no Samach. So Asemis points out also the Menorah, when the Torah talks about the Menorah, which is the symbol of Torah, which is all influence, not receiver, but all divine emanation, so that also has no Samach. And of course the Samach is the letter of curse. Blessing in the sense that it's a perfect circle and guaranteed continuity, but it's a curse in the sense that there's no point of origin. And obviously what's needed is, by the way, that's why the bride walks around the groom. That's the custom, an Ashkenazi custom in a wedding. Isha tesevev geve, the woman surrounds the man. The symbol of the chuppah is that he takes her into his domain. The chuppah is his home. What is the symbol of chuppah? Why do we make a chuppah? In case it rains. By the way, we should get married under the stars. It's a very special thing to get married outdoors. It's a custom. But the chuppah is a method of the man taking the woman into his domain. But she, when she enters his domain, she walks around him. As I give you a place to be. That's what it means. And of course it's seven times. Seven is the female number. Bat Sheva. So she walks seven times around him. She defines his place. And that symbol of a ring is like that. So the Torah says, how do you know you marry a woman? You give her something. One of the methods of marriage is you give her something of value, provided she accepts it. Of course, she has to agree that this is for marriage. So Moses says, how do you know? Because we have the expression of marriage in the Torah is ki yikach ish isha, when a man takes a woman. By the way, it's the man who takes. In marriage, in Jewish marriage, all the activity is done by the man. The woman accepts. Marriage is done by the man. Divorce is done by the man too. Right? He gives, she receives. He gives the ring or the object. He gives a bill of divorce, she receives. She has to be, she has to consent, of course, in both cases. Right? Not a passive receiving. But she's an active receiving, but she's the receiver. He's the mashpia, the influencer, the one who moves. She's the one who accepts. So how do you know that marriage is affected that way? How do you know that a woman bonds her domain into his when he gives her an object in exchange for that domain? So the Torah says, because the word used is ki yikach ish isha, when man takes a woman. And there's another time the Torah uses that word. This is called gzeira shava. There's a technique in Torah learning when the Torah uses the same word in two places where we have a tradition, then all the details of the one can be applied to the other. And all the details of the other can be applied to the one. Is that clear? If the Torah has two separate sections, both of which using the same keyword, provided we are informed that that's where the connection is made, then we know that we can connect the two sections. Is this clear? Yes? It's called a common factor. So when it says a man takes a woman, there's another place in the Torah where it says that Avram Avinu, Abraham, bought a field. He bought a field from Ephron. And then it says also the word taking. Actually, the way it says it over there is he said to Ephron, I take the field from you. Here's the money. Take it from me. Kach mimeni. Take the money from me. When you take the money from me, the field becomes mine. So the Gemara says like this. You see that taking a woman, use a certain word. He's taking a field, buying a field, use the same word. So we learn that just like you can buy a field for money, you can marry a woman with money or value or consideration. A ring or whatever the value is. So far, so good? Are we together? The simple exercise in Gemara, right? How do you know that you marry a woman? By giving her value. Who knows? Maybe it's down on your head. I don't know. Maybe you have to get on your knees and beg. How do you know that you give her something and she accepts it and bonds her domain into yours? Because the Torah says a man takes a woman and a man takes a field. And the same word is used. So there's an acquisition in terms of buying and an acquisition in terms of marriage. And since the same word is used in both places, we know the same methodology applies. That's what the Gemara says. But a little thought, anyone who thinks about this should realize. Why did the Torah choose to teach it there? Why did the Torah choose to teach marrying a woman with the same word as buying a field? So the Gemara says, because a woman is a man's field. That's where the produce grows. Gemara says, how do you know that the man isn't the woman's field? So no, she's his field, as it were. The expression, the marital expression is. That's where the produce grows, as it were. And by the way, it's an incredible thing. What kind of field was it that he bought? What field did he buy? It wasn't a wheat field. It was a field where not wheat is planted, but where people are. It was a burial ground. What did Avraham Avinu buy from Ephron? He bought the Machpelah. What is planted in the Machpelah? People. That's the field of real growth. Who's buried there? Avram, Adam and Chava, Avram and Sarah, yeah, Yaakov and Leah, Yitzhak and Rivka. By the way, the word Machpelah means doubled, where man and wife are doubled. Machpelah in Hebrew means a doubled, the Gemara says a doubled cave. One cave inside another, one cave above another. It's where connection is made between two things, the male and female connection, point of perfect meeting. He was buying a place for himself and his wife to be buried or planted. What is the meaning of burying a human being? Why do we bury people, by the way? Why do we bury people? Why don't we, you know, vaporize them more? Freeze them. Cremate them. Dice them. We bury people because it's a planting. It's a planting for Tchias HaMeisim. Man's taken from the earth and he's put back there for a final growing, which is a... So they bought the image of marriage, an amazing thing. The image of marriage is the image of an eternal planting, where husband and wife will lie together in the earth and there will be an eternal growing. Where is the Machpelah, by the way? Where is the cave of the Machpelah? Where is it? Where? In Hebron. What is Hebron? Hebron means a... Chibur in Hebrew means that two things join. Chevron means, chaver is a friend, where two people bond into friendship. Chevron is a place where two things join. It's obvious. So the perfect place to teach marriage, when a man takes a woman and forms that two-ness, that duplication, that bond, that is the seed of eternity. The perfect place to learn it is from Avram Avinu, the original Jewish marriage, Abraham and Sarah. Taking a field, which is a place of burial and growth, not of wheat or produce, but of human beings. The Gemara is in one place an incredible description. There's not in public the place to go into it in detail, but of Avram and Sarah being together in the Machpelah. One of the person was allowed to go in and see, and it says, he saw Avram looking into Sarah's head. Perfect unity. So that's the concept. Maleness, it's not, you know, modern superficial world, male and female sort of, I don't know, biologically slightly different accidentally. Slightly accidentally different creatures. That's not the concept. Maleness and femaleness are two opposite ends of a spectrum. Maleness represents the Shemaim, as it were, the giving dimension, unlimited giving dimension, and female represents the completely limited receiving dimension. And only between the two of them can you have the skill of the woman is to take that unlimited energy of the male, give it limitation, but only just enough limitation that it lives in the world. The danger of the female is to take it and freeze it so solid and so concrete that it can't move. The woman has to take that spark of flame. The female has to take from the male that spark of an energy that is only just beginning and fan it to a flame and then release it. When the pregnancy gets to a certain stage, it has to tear itself away in pain and danger. And that's life in the world. When children grow, they have to be allowed to leave too, painfully. The perfect relationship between male and female is where the maleness is an unbounded energy and the female is giving it enough shape and form that it can be real in the world, but not so much that it freezes and dies. Tremendous skill. She has to feed enough form into it, enough material for that form to, so that it's always alive, it's always making more. The male danger is just to waste energy, potentiality, all over the place. Many relationships, many unlimited relationships. That's real immorality. The wastage of that seed energy. A very serious thing. It applies to all sorts of things in the body. It applies to words, talking nonsense, wasting words, wasting time. It's all seed energy that's wasted. That's a real death force in the world. And the female danger, is to make the thing so frozen and solid that it has no life left. It can't hold on to a pregnancy, that kills it. It has to be given enough material until it must continue on its own and do its own, produce itself again. What does this have to do with Noach, Noah? The Zohar says an amazing thing, that the place of male and female meeting must be a fixed place. Must be a fixed place. That's what the ark is. The Tevas Noach, the ark, is a place that's fixed. No accident that that word in Hebrew is the same word for place where the Torah is kept. The Teva, Tevas Noach, the Zohar says that. The Zohar says that the ark was the place where human beings were kept above the flood, and the ark is the place where the Torah is kept. It needs a fixed place. Actually, the Zohar says there's a third meaning to the word Teva. And Teva in Hebrew has another meaning. You know what that is? Teva in Hebrew means an ark, a box, a ship, a vessel, an ark. But it also means a word. It means a word. Torah is the word that forms the world. You know what the dimensions of the Teva were? It was 300 long. No. 50 wide and 30 high. So in Hebrew, if you put those three letters together, the letter for 300, for 50, and for 3, it's Lashon, the tongue. Lamad is 30, Shin is 300, and Nun is 50. Now, the Zohar points it out. Speech, the world began with speech. Hashem spoke it into existence. And it began again, a second edition, as it were, a second version of being spoken into the world. And that is a Noach, the word Noah means to come to rest. Why was the world formed from a man whose name means to be at rest? So many sources say that Noach means Shabbat. Noach is Shabbos, Shabbat. Shabbat means to sit in one place, to shvu ishtachtav, sit. You know, the law of Shabbos is that you're not allowed to leave your place. You know that? The Torah law is on Shabbat, you cannot leave your place. You can't leave your place on Shabbat. Quite apart from the problem of working. 39 actions you can't do on Shabbat. You can't go out of your place on Shabbat. If you live in a city, so the city is your place with a certain measure around the city. But let's say you're in the wilderness. You're traveling in the desert. No city, no buildings. The sun goes down Friday afternoon. You can't move from your place. You're literally your place. A couple of meters by... Can't move. Shabbat is where things come to rest. There's no place to go. This is it. The word Shabbat means to sit. Noach means to come to rest. And the reason is male and female need to meet in a place that is fixed. There's a place for this. That's what a Jewish home is. The word bet that we get began the Torah with means buy it. It means a home. There's one place in the Gemara where one of the great sages said, I never called my wife, I always called her my home. Yeah. I never called her Ishti, my wife, I called her Beiti, my home. What does that mean? Because the woman gives a place to be, and it needs to be a fixed place. Male-female meeting without fixed place, again, that's a looseness and immorality in the world. Now, of course, that Shabbat is the special time and the time for that place, if you like. Where's the ultimate place of male and female meeting? The Beis HaMikdash in the temple. No? That's the ultimate bite. And it's an intimate place of meeting. The Gemara says that where the temple stands is the Asra Danashka Shmayavara, where heaven and earth kiss. By the way, it's also where the world speaks. What happens in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash? What happens in the temple? It's where heaven and earth kiss, means an intimate meeting of the male dimension of the higher world and the lower dimension of the physical world. It's a place where Hashem's voice is heard from the two golden angels, which are male and female, by the way, embracing each other, on top of the ark. That is the place of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, and that's called Mikdash. That's holiness. Holiness is male and female meeting in a special place, in a place that's fixed. And the Zohar says that. The Zohar says that Noah was chosen because it's not just a place where, it's not just the opportunity for male and female to meet and for the world to continue, but there's a special place for that. And that's called the Teva. That's a side issue. But man and female are these dimensions. Let's just take one example maybe for this evening. Obviously it's an endless subject. As the Kabbalists say, everything in the world has father and mother. Everything in the world has a male and female dimension. A right and a left, an influence and a receiver, if you like. Lights and vessels, as the Kabbalists say. The lights are male, the vessels are female. Let's take one example. There should be a marriage in the mind as well. A correctly developed mind. Apart from the relationship issue of male and female, or master and disciple, which is also male and female. When a Rebbe and a Talmud relate to each other, when the master teaches the disciple, that's a marital relationship. Very intimate relationship. There's an influence, the one who influences, that's the master. There's a disciple where it comes to rest, he can only hold as much as he can hold. The master can teach much more than the student can hold. The student is limited. He hasn't grown to that level yet. He has a limited vessel. That's why a great teacher only teaches as much as the vessel can hold. An immature teacher teaches whatever he has. He can destroy the student that way. The Chovas HaLevavos says the mature teacher is just like the mother's breast gives milk only what the child needs. Too much is smother him, and too little you'll be thirsty. The milk is produced exactly according to the need. Great Rav Simcha Wasserman, his Yortzeit was this week, he used to say that the sages say that in connection with a master and a disciple, the Rebbe and the Talmud, so the sages put it like this, they say that more than the calf wants to suckle, the cow wants to nurse. More than the calf wants to drink, the cow wants to give milk. Meaning, more than the student wants to learn, the Rebbe wants to teach. A person of Torah greatness or spiritual wisdom, he really wants to teach. That's what he's in the world for. So people misunderstand. They think that more than the calf wants to drink, the cow wants to give. She's heavy with milk. She needs to give her milk. That's not what the cow wants to do. The cow doesn't want to give her milk because she's heavy with milk. The cow wants the calf to drink. The mother's not interested in giving as much as she can. The mother's interested in giving what the child needs. Giving as much as you can might be much too much. It might be an overload. The great teacher teaches exactly what the student needs to learn. When this great man died, I had the privilege, I was very close to him, our family's related. He was 92. And when he died, he left at Savoy a will, you know, an ethical will, you call it. Amazing things. One page. I have a copy. You're welcome to see it. And he wrote something like this. He wrote, after I die, no one's allowed to say, you know, a hesped, a eulogy, no one may say anything about me. People of spiritual greatness are terrified by the thought of a eulogy because somebody will get up and say something about you. After you die, when people speak about you, the problem is they have to say the truth. When you're alive, people say all false things about you. It's wonderful. What could be better? You know, I travel around the world. I have to give speeches. Very often I come to a place and someone gets up to introduce me and they go on with this amazing... No, it's hard to believe they're actually talking about you. You know, it's the only person who could believe it would be my mother. You know? And the less accurate it is, the better. But the better, you know, it's just wonderful. When you leave this world, there's nothing worse. In this world of falsehood, when they praise you, it's wonderful. When you leave this world and you're listening from the world of truth and they're not saying truth, nothing hurts worse. And therefore, a eulogy, a hesped, has to be exactly true. It's a wonderful thing to do. It's a fantastic mitzvah. It must be done. So he said, when I die, no one is allowed to say anything about me, unless my Rebbetzin's still alive. If she's still alive, obviously for her it wouldn't be an honor to say something about him, then I will allow them to speak about me, but only one person, and he only may say one thing. And this is what he may say. Actually, two things. All he's allowed to say about me is that I tried my best to teach each student according to his need. And secondly, I was able to help some people along the way in their learning and so on. And then I realized this great man of 92 years of greatness, he saw his life's work as being teaching how, not what he had to teach, but to teach what each student needed. The student needs less, you have to give less. He needs it slower, you have to give it slower. He needs more, you have to give more. That's the relationship between parent and child, master and disciple. These are all male-female pairs. In the Kabbalistic works, is that before the world was created, before heaven and earth were created, lights and vessels were created. And the original problem was that too much light went into the vessels and the vessels broke. I'm sure you're all black belt Kabbalists and I'm sure you're familiar with this. That's what it says. Before the world there were vessels created and lights came out. And the lights went into the vessels, but the lights were too strong. Too much for the vessels broke. And that led to the potential for breakdown in the world. Sparks, only little sparks were left in the vessels. But in the mind there has to be a male-female pair. And let's spend just a moment on that. Take one example. There are two faculties in the mind. In our sources they're called Seichel and Dimyon. Very hard to translate. Seichel you call thought, intelligence, intellect, wisdom. Dimyon means imagination. So let's study this just for a few moments. Grasping this idea correctly can lead to correct thinking. A person understands this well, have controlled thought in the most powerfully productive fashion. There are two faculties in the mind. Let's do it like this. You know, one of the ways of speaking about male and female in the most abstract fashion is to talk about what we call chomer and sura. Chomer and sura. Sura means pattern, form. And chomer means material. Can you see the male-female pair? Form, pattern, shape is the male dimension, but it's purely theoretical. The material, the clay, the earth, is formless, but it's real, it's tangible. And if you never have male without female, you can never have material without some shape. You can think theoretically of material without a shape, but a lump of clay, it has some shape. And you can never have form without material. You can never have a pattern without something to express it. Think of a triangle. You need three thin black lines. You need something. Theoretically, you can imagine a triangle, I suppose. You can think of the concept of a triangle, but you can't picture it. You can't do it in the world. Is this clear? All form needs a medium to express it. And all medium always takes on a form. The perfect harmony between the two is when the right form finds the right medium and the right medium expresses the correct form. And that's real beauty when male and female meet. The wrong version is where the material is always looking for a new form to express. That's called prostitution. It's the female dimension looking for a new male and it doesn't satisfy. It's one form now and tomorrow a new form. That's called znus, which means immorality. The two must be perfectly harmonized, where you have the material. That's called Chomer and Sura. It's one of the most famous expressions of this male-female pair. There's the Chomer, the material. There's the Tsura, the form. The two match each other perfectly. In the mind, you have Tsura, which is called Seichel. That means the pattern of logic, of thought. And you have Dimyon, which is imagination. But when we say imagination, we mean image a nation. We mean images. Think about it for a moment. How do you think? When you think, you realize there are two things happening in your mind at the same time. There's a logical process, and there are pictures on which that operates. Is that correct? Imagine you have to solve a problem. It's a problem in your family. How do you solve the problem? Well, you think logically from one step to the next, but each step calls up images. No? Yes? You can't think pure logic. The closest you can get to thinking pure logic is mathematical thought, where the images are just symbols. Arithmetic, where they're numbers. Algebra, where they're more abstract, they're just general symbols. But there has to be some symbol. You can't think a logical process without some objects. Is this correct? And the two are completely opposite. The logical process is male. The images are female. The perfect harmony is where the logic, the process, is using only the correct images and meshing with those images only long enough to get to the next step and then the next correct image. Where's the power? The power is always in the female. The female is called gvura, right? Power. Very easy to demonstrate. Where's all the power? Sit back in an easy chair, close your eyes, relax. Which dimension operates? Logical thought or imagination? only imagination. And imagination on its own has no logic at all. When you lose control of the logical process, this is what happens. An image pops into your mind, an image. Why does it pop in? Some long-lost association. And as that image pops into your mind, it triggers another association. And as you think of that thing, you picture that thing, it triggers another memory, a smell. And that triggers something else, and you go from one image to another with no logical connection. It usually happens when you're trying to daven Shmon Esrei. Right? Usually, you say to yourself, now you're really going to concentrate. Take three steps forward. Now you're going to focus on every word. And before you know it, you're taking three steps back and you've just been in Hong Kong. The female dimension, one image calls up another with no logical connection. That's called dimyon. Dimyon means an image. It may be a smell, a picture, a memory, an image, imagination. Dimyon, one thing similar to another, and that triggers an association. And free association, one thing after another. In fact, the humiliating part of it is by the time you get to the end, you can't even remember how you got there. You don't remember where you began. Try to solve a logical problem. You start concentrating. Before you know it, you who knows where. Sometimes you can't even remember what the problem was you set out to solve. That's very, very undisciplined thinking. Very bad use of the mind. Tragedy to waste the mind on that. And yet you can't think logically without images. The perfect harmony is where the logic picks up only the image that's necessary. Rides it, and you can have different, let's say a great artist. A great creative artist has tremendous potency in the images that associate with each other, but there's always a logical theme. Otherwise, not a work of art, it's just a mess. A great work of art has a unifying theme. If you like, it's like an enormous animal, maybe a very powerful horse with a very small rider. But the rider's directing. The opposite is a great logical mind, a great mathematician. Tremendously powerful intellect. Very faint images, just symbols. But the correct symbols. They're different balances. More female, less male. More male, less female. But each one in perfect harmony with the other. That small rider on that massive horse knows exactly what he's doing. The onlooker looks like a runaway horse. But the rider knows with the small nudges and subtleties he's guiding the horse. And the great powerful intellect is using very small amounts of material, but exactly what's needed. Disciplined thinking means that you take your problem, you go from step one to step two with only the image that's necessary. All the extraneous stuff that the emotions well up are completely banished. And when step two is settled and consolidated, you move to step three using only the image that's necessary.
So, can you explain again why the image of a female and not male? Because the images are...
It's material.
Material.
It's material. It's not... The images are... They're not logical elements. They're pictures, a particular vivid memory. That's the chomer. That's specific and finite.
But they can actually be infinite because you can actually roll if you're...
The rolling on is male.
Sorry?
The rolling on, the process is male.
Is a male.
The objects are female.
Emotion.
The artist who shapes the clay. The process, the movement, each shape that it takes is male. But the material is always... The material is always there. You can only express one shape. You can't have two images in the mind at the same time. The clay can only have one image at a time. It can rapidly form from one image to the next. It can morph from one to another. But the same, a lump of clay can only be in one shape at any finite point in time. It can rapidly change.
So the image is actually created by the logic.
No, it should be disciplined. It should be controlled by the logic. Moved from... Again. Logical thought is... Let's make it simple. In a mathematical problem, you have to solve a process of logic. How do you do it? You call up the image that's needed. A number, a symbol, a set of symbols, a set of numbers. They are related correctly. Then you move to the second step of the problem. Then you use the new symbols, the new numbers, the new whatever it is. Correct? And the process works on them, and then moves to the new one, the next. But only the numbers that are necessary. If unnecessary numbers and symbols get in there, the whole thing's a wreck. No? The artist uses the material that he needs, no less and no more. And it takes a perfect form and a perfect shape, and it moves to the next. And each part is necessary, and there's nothing lacking, and there's nothing extra. Logical thought. Each image you need is essential. Nothing lacking, nothing extra. But it's very difficult. If you can concentrate on one subject for 1 minute, you're very unusual. Try it. I challenge you. When you get home, don't do it now. Get home. Sit in a room by yourself. Try to think about one subject for 1 minute. Very embarrassing. Not only won't you get to the end of the minute, you won't remember what you try and think about by the end of the minute. You probably won't remember your name. Very humiliating. If you can discipline yourself, and that's why the Rambam says when you daven Shmon Esrei, when you try to get through the Amidah, the law is you only have to have intention for the first one of 19. Very humiliating. The law is that if you find yourself lapsing, let's say you start, right? You get through the first bracha, and by the time you get to the end, you've lost concentration. Do you have to go back and repeat it? You're talking to God. Don't. How would you like to be someone having a conversation with you, and after the first three words, they've wandered off? You're talking to God. Says the Rambam, as long as you had intention for the first blessing, you... And you know what he says? Even more humiliating. He says, and if you realize that you didn't have intention for the first one, even then you don't go back. You know why? You'll get it wrong again. Very humiliating. And the way to discipline the mind is, when you daven Shmon Esrei, prayer is an intense meditation. Tremendous training in meditation, in focus. The first exercise is train yourself for a month to mean every word of one bracha, that's all. Just the first one. Just one bracha, every word. The simple meaning, we're not talking about fancy footwork and Kabbalistic references and all sorts of zivugim and cosmic effects. Just the simple meaning of the simple words, especially Hashem's name, one blessing only. If you can get that right, then you do too. A person that can concentrate all the way through Shmon Esrei, he can get from the first word to the last word, focusing simply on what each word means, is a very, very developed human being. It's very humiliating, but that's what it is. The reason is that the female dimension is very powerful and has no logic. Potent. Rich with emotion. Image. Form. You know, the material. But no logic. And the maleness is logical process. Very weak. Extremely weak. Easily taken by the female and seduced into illogical, fat and juicy images. A very powerful mind is one who can relax, and the only things that go through the mind are things of purity. Very hard, very, very hard. A relaxed mind usually... not so clean. Not so pure. It takes tremendous training. That's an example of a male and female marriage. In here, in each individual, different proportions, depending on different personalities, different purposes, different times. Anyway, what we studied this evening was the beginning of the subject of heaven and earth, male and female, Hashem and his world, husband and wife, male and female, Chomer and Surah, material, or form and material. Seichel and Dimyon, the intellect, and the images that it uses. The whole world. Everything in the world is male and female. And therefore, here at the beginning of the Torah, one of the things to understand, of course, is how the oneness becomes two. These are two opposites that must mesh into a perfect harmony. The real oneness is where the two mesh into a beauty. The place of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, is called, Yerushalayim is called Tzion Michlal Yofi, the most beautiful place on earth. It means spiritually beautiful. Jerusalem physically is not necessarily the most beautiful place on earth. Physically. I don't know, maybe Switzerland. I don't know. South Africa for sure. But no place like that in terms of spiritual beauty. Spiritual beauty means where male and female kiss in perfect harmony. The place of the temple is called Sion. Sion. Tzion is the same numerical equivalent as the word Yosef, Joseph. Many of the Midrash says all the things that happened to Yosef happened to Tzion. Joseph is the perfect place of meeting of male and female. He's the only male in the Torah described with a female beauty. It's a long subject. But the perfect, beautiful meeting of male and female is where there's a perfect harmony. There's the intellect and the dimion providing the rich images that are needed without taking over. Or the resolute husband and wife. Or lights and vessels, or whatever it is in the world. But this is a consciousness, one develops this, one works towards seeing each one fully and beautifully and meshing into something that really gets back to the original oneness.